There are various legends, stories about Alexander the Great. Seems that he was known for anger. There's an amusing story that tells about when he came to England. I'm sorry, for any historians, they would love that. India. It sounds similar, doesn't it? He learned about the bravery, the fearlessness of the people of India, made friends with them, and he was impressed by the stories of their yogi, their swami, their wise men. And he heard about them, was very desirous of seeing one, and wanted to actually encourage one to allow him to take him back to Greece with him. And so they told Alexander that these yogis, not related to bear, though they lived in the forest, and that's the point, that they dwelt in the forest. And so Alexander goes into a forest to find one, and sure enough, he encounters one sitting under a tree meditating, and Alexander patiently waits there until he opens his eyes. Alexander tells him what he wants to do. He implores him, "I really want you to come with me. People would love to meet you, and whatever you want, I'll give you whatever you want. You can have anything, and the world lays at your feet." And the yogi quietly said, "I need nothing. I'm happy where I am." Well, Alexander didn't like this, so he got angry. He threatened to kill the man. And the yogi kind of shook Alexander up with his response. He said, "You can't kill me. You can kill my body, but my body is just a garment. You take my body away, and I'm not my body. That which dwells within me is me." And then he says, "You say that you're a king." Because Alexander had identified him in such a way. He says, "May I tell you who you really are? You are a slave of my slave." Well, this was really quite a shock to Alexander, and he asked him to explain this. And the yogi said, "I have mastered anger. Anger is my slave. See how easily you gave way to anger? You gave way to anger, making you a slave of anger, and anger is my slave. It doesn't control me, I control it. So you are a slave of my slave." Another account that I read where he went to a wise man, and the man told him, "What do you want?" And Alexander said, I've conquered the world, I need to know what else I can do." And he said, "Go conquer yourself." Maybe familiar with the account of Cletus the Black, who was an officer in Alexander's army. He was a childhood friend, was his best friend. He had recently saved Alexander's life. And yet in a drunken rage, Alexander ran Cletus through with a spear. And so these Indian individuals, these wise men, apparently were right. Alexander, the king of the world, was a slave of anger. You can be a powerful person and still be very weak. You can be a powerful person and be a slave to something. Many people are. In fact, most people are. I invite you to turn with me to Judges chapter 13. I'm going to spend a few minutes there this evening. Judges chapter 13 introduces us to a very well-known man, a man known for his strength, a man by the name of Samson. I'd like to read the first 7 verses as well as verses 19 and 20. It says, again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. There was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren, had no children. Angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, indeed, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now, therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and not to eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. He shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. So the woman came and told her husband, saying, a man of God came to me. His countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God. Very awesome, but I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. He said to me, behold, now you shall conceive and bear a son. Drink no wine or similar drink. Eat anything unclean, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. And then Noah asks, prays to the Lord, actually, to send this man back. The man returns, the man, the angel of God, and they go through very similar information, and then Manoah wants to offer a sacrifice. We pick up down in verses 19 and 20. And so Manoah took the young goat that he brought with the grain offering, offered it upon the rock to the Lord. He did a wondrous thing, this angel, while Manoah and his wife looked on. As the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, it happened that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. Thought they'd seen the face of God. He did. He thought that he was going to die, and she assured him that wasn't the case. But we have a couple of common individuals here who have witnessed something that very few people, no doubt, have witnessed. They have the promised birth of a child. Anticipation. Not just any child. This is a couple who was barren, a couple who wanted children. Now they know they're going to have children, but this is not going to be just any ordinary child. This is a child promised from a very angel of God. Can you imagine the possibilities that they think of? What's going to happen? How this is going to impact their lives? Their influence in this? What their child is going to do and accomplish? Probably no concern. No thought maybe of any kind of heartache that they may endure as a result of this child promised by an angel of God. Bible says nothing of the early years, very, very little. We got one little snippet, what we might call the silent years of Samuel growing up, down in verses 19 and 20, verses 24 and 25, we're told after these things that the woman bore a son, called his name Samson, and the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Menea Dan, between Zorah and Eshtel. That's all the information we're given there. The child grew, and the Lord blessed him. We have no reason to conclude anything other than that these were good people, his parents, godly parents. There's no mention of any kind of habits or problems that they have in their lives, though I'm sure they had some. Seemed to be individuals who took things very seriously. No doubt a good influence on their son. They demonstrated that by their persistent concern for what was right when the angel came. Back in verse 8 and verses 11 and 12, in verse 8, after the wife tells Manoah about the angel, it says, Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, O my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born. Verses 11 and 12. So Manoah arose and followed his wife. When he came to the man, he said to him, are you the man who spoke to this woman? He said, I am. Manoah said, Now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work? Oh, that all parents had such an attitude, such a concern for the direction of their children's lives. Samson, of course, is known for his strength. We see him killing a lion in chapter 14, verses 5 and 6. And the description of it there is quite interesting. He goes to Timnah with his father and mother, came to the vineyards of Timnah. To his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. He tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. I can't imagine tearing apart a young goat, but apparently that must be a lot more easily done than doing so to a lion, though he had nothing in his hand. But he didn't tell his father, mother, what he had done. Then another occasion recorded in chapter 15, he kills 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. Verses 14 and 15, he came to Lehi. The Philistines came shouting against him. His own people had delivered him into their hands upon agreement that they wouldn't harm him. It says, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. The ropes that were on his arms became like flax that's burned with fire. His bonds were broke loose from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. We find that he's faster than foxes. Not only is he strong, but he's able to catch 300 foxes in chapter 15, verses 4 and 5. But I thought I had these in correct order. Somehow I must have gotten these backwards. I did. We're told that Samson went and caught 300 foxes, took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, put a torch between each pair of tails. When he set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks of the standing grain as well as the vineyards and the olive groves. And then the last occasion that I'll refer to was where he carried off the gates of Gaza. Chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. Samson went to Gaza, saw a harlot there, went into her. When the Gazites were told Samson has come here, they surrounded the place, lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were quiet all night, saying, in the morning when it's daylight, we will kill him. Samson lay low till midnight. He arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. What an impressive individual. Mighty feats of strength. And yet Samson, like all men, had weaknesses. You may not have known this, but Samson had eye trouble. The Bible tells us so. If you'll look at chapter 14, verses 1 and 2, Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughter of the Philistines, the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up, told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. I have seen her. I like what I see. Therefore, I want her. Chapter 16, verse 1. We already looked at this, but we're told Samson went to Gaza, and here it is again, saw a harlot there and went into her. Chapter 16 and verse 4. Afterward it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. Samson had a weakness. We're going to see that this weakness certainly offset his strength. Samson had a false idea of playing with sin. Perhaps because of his great physical strength, he may have thought that he was simply impervious to failure, that he was strong enough to handle anything physically and spiritually as well. He was wrong. By looking at the account of Samson, we can see some things that sin brings on anyone who gives themselves to it. For example, we see that sin brings recklessness. We'll spend pretty much the rest of this account in chapter 16. And you're familiar with the account here where he meets Delilah, as indicated there in verse 4 that we looked at, and she begins to beg him to tell her the source of his strength. And so, actually, we're beginning with the end of the story here when we look down at verse 17, and there's a reason for that. We'll see that as we go. He tells her three things that are incorrect about the source of his strength. And then finally, he opens his heart to her in this verse and tells her, the text says, all his heart. And he said to her, no razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. We see here the evolution of sin. Samson didn't just blurt this out without any reluctance. If you had told Samson just several days earlier that he would reveal this information, he probably would have said, you're out of your mind. Sin progressively leads you down a more reckless path. After continuing in some sin, a person will do things that he never dreamed that he would do. Classic example, I'm sure, of this is the account of David with Bathsheba over in 2 Samuel chapter 11. We read verses 1 through 4. 2 Samuel 11, verses 1 through 4. Came to pass in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, and all Israel. And they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Reba, but David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? David sent messengers and took her. She came to him. He lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity. She returned to her house. Now, if you'd told David at that moment that he was going to have her husband murdered just some weeks from now, he probably would have thought you were crazy. Again, we're taking this concept from the end and looking backwards. And that can be a helpful thing to do. David, you up for murder? Well, no. You up for deceit? No. When he just looked at the woman, are you up for adultery? No. I'm just looking. And then, of course, we see the progression. Looking leads to the lust. Lust leads to the adultery. The adultery leads to the deceit, the attempted deceit. The deceit leads to the murder. This is the nature of sin. Sin is destructive. One will do it secretly at first, but later he will become reckless with it. Someone has said, sin in secret brings sin in sight. It will not stay there hidden in the shadows. One way or another, it will come out. It will come out in your personality. It will come out in action sometimes. We see Samson's reckless progression in chapter 16. This now picks up and takes those incidents in order, where Samson is with Delilah and she says to him, if you love me, please tell me where your... Well, she first says, verse 6, please tell me where your great strength lies, with what you may be bound to afflict you. So he tells her, first of all, bowstrings. This is the string of an archer's bow, traditionally made of three strands of hemp. And I think an older translation says strings of grass. Well, this would be grass technically, but you'd have a wrong impression, as I understand, if you thought of just grass, taking some grass and wrapping it around. But these are bowstrings. Well, it doesn't stop there. As she pushes him more, he tells her in verse 11, if they buy me, well, we understand the account, so I don't feel the need to walk through it all. She tied him up in this manner, and then he broke those off as nothing. And then she begins to pester him again. Look, you've mocked me, verse 10, and told me lies. Please tell me what you may be bound with. He said to her in verse 11, if they bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used, I shall become weak and be like any other man. And she did this. We're told in verse 12 at the last part of it that he broke them off his arms like a thread. Verse 13 then, she says, until now you've mocked me and told me lies. So she presses him even more, and he says to her in the latter part of verse 13, if you weave the seven locks of my head into the web of the loom. So she wove it tightly with a batten of the loom and said to him, the Philistines are upon you. Picture here, I don't know, that was supposed to be taken out, but maybe you've seen pictures like this, I don't know. This is an actual photo that was on, I'm just kidding. But the kind of like dreadlocks, I suppose, maybe is the idea there. Seven locks, or some translation says seven braids of my hair. And so if you weave those, some translations say, into the fabric of the loom and tighten it with a pin, I become weak. And of course, we see the progression here in and of itself, that he's getting closer to the truth. But then finally, he says in verse 17, when she says, how can you say that you love me? Verse 15, she pesters him. It came to pass, verse 16, when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him so that his soul was vexed to death, that he told her all his heart and said to her, no razor has ever come upon my head. I've been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, my strength will leave me. I shall become weak and be like any other man. Again, for him to think that he would tell her this days earlier would have no doubt been unbelievable to him. This was a well-guarded secret. And yet as he goes through this encounter and is tempted more and more and pressured more and more and feels the power of temptation, he finally gives in and does the thing that he thought he would never do. And sin brings powerlessness. Down in verse 20, we're told after she had actually had his head shaved, verse 19, she lulled him to sleep on her knees, called for a man, had him shave off the seven locks of his head. She began to torment him, and his strength left him. Verse 20, she said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. So he awoke from his sleep and said, I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. There's a great lie that Satan perpetuates, and that is that sin is manliness. Or when dealing with the feminine gender, I don't know how you say that, maybe toughness. I'm in control. I call my own shots. Nobody tells me what to do. One may think they're powerful when they are given to sin. Some thrive on anger. Some thrive on bitterness, hatred, resentment. They think this makes them strong. They come across very aggressively. But these things are actually signs of weakness, as we talked about earlier with Alexander the Great. You're really just showing that you're a slave. They show lack of self-control. In this respect, I think of David. When he gave into temptation with Bathsheba, Uriah wouldn't follow David's plans. David had to take matters into his own hands. Back in 2 Samuel 11, verses 14 through 17, He had Uriah brought in from the battlefield, and he tries to arrange things so that Uriah will go home and lay with his wife. Uriah refuses to do this on a couple of occasions, so David finally sends him back to the battlefield. Verse 14, in the morning it was so that David wrote a letter to Joab, sent it by the hand of Uriah. He wrote in the letter saying, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat from him, that he may be struck down and die." So it happened while Joab besieged the city that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. Then the men of the city came out and fought with Joab. Some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Verse 18, then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messenger, saying, "When you finish telling the matter of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath rises, he says to you, 'Why did you approach so near to the city when you fought? Did you not know what they would shoot from the wall?'" And then he tells this story, and then he tells him in the end of verse 21, "Also say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'" Now Joab's not some kind of dummy here. Wonder what's going on in Joab's mind about all this. Something tells me this wasn't the only thing that Joab knew on David. For some reason, prior to this, David seemed powerless with Joab. Back in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 39, you may recall the account of Abner coming and seeking alliance with David. And because of a past deed with Abner, killing a brother, Joab actually kills him. And David says in 2 Samuel 3, verse 39, "Today, though I am anointed the king, I am weak. And these sons of Zeruiah," Joab and his brother, "are too strong for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds." Maybe I'm making something out of something that's not there. But he calls himself weak. He refuses to deal with Abner in a way that justice would seem to have demanded. David knew that Joab had done wrong in that instance, but he wouldn't deal with it. And then I'm confident that after this account with Bathsheba, this account with Uriah more specifically, that David's reluctance to deal with Joab became even more pronounced. Joab's not a fool. Why would you put Uriah up front and then draw back from him and allow him to be killed? Do you not think that David's guilt would have affected him around Joab from this day forward? Joab knew this was murder. Do you think Joab was surprised when he came back to Jerusalem and happened to see Bathsheba there is a part of David's harem? Do you not think this weakened David? And so instead of meting out justice to Joab, he leaves it for the next king. He lays this burden, this responsibility in the lap of his son. What a cowardly thing to do. 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, he tells Solomon, "You yourself know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me, what he did to the two commanders of Israel's army, Abner, son of Ner, and Amos, son of Jether. He killed them, shedding their blood in peacetime as if in battle. And with that blood, he stained the belt around his waist and the sandals on his feet. Deal with him according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to the grave in peace." Well, why didn't you do that, David? Sin weakens. Sin strips away a person's moral courage. And so the mighty Samson was rendered powerless by sin long before his actual strength was taken from him. We see that sin brings blindness. Back to Judges chapter 16. And the first part of verse 21, when Samson's head was shaved and the Philistines came up on him, his strength had departed from him. We're told, Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. Now, I'm using this metaphorically as a representation of the blindness of sin. But in Proverbs chapter 7, we encounter a young man, as he's described, and we see the same kind of blindness there that we see with Samson. This is verses 6 through 27, but I'm only going to read a few portions of that. Proverbs chapter 6. Chapter 7, I'm sorry, verse 6. At the window of my house, I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner. He took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. Sorry, I'm trying to keep up with two things at once here. She was loud and rebellious, and her feet would not stay home. And then it tells about the conversation she has with him, how she seduces him, allures him with her speech and with all the details about how she's prepared everything and what he can expect. And verses 21 through 23 says, with her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver as a bird hastens to the snare. He did not know that it would take his life. Now, if somebody again had walked up to him in the midst of this conversation and said, are you ready to die? Are you ready to go as an ox goes to the slaughter? Are you ready to go as a fool goes to the correction of the stocks? Are you ready to be struck in the liver with an arrow? He would have thought this most ridiculous. And of course, these are not literal statements. He's destroying his life. He's destroying his soul. He's destroying his character. But he thought that his eyes were wide open, when in fact he was absolutely blind to what inevitably lay ahead. And again, David serves as an example back in 2 Samuel. This time we'll be in chapter 12. His sin with Bathsheba, he no doubt thought he'd taken care of things. She'd gone back home. He'd made his attempts with Uriah. He got that mess dealt with when he had Uriah put to death. He brings her into his own home, and everything's fine, right? He thought he'd covered his tracks, but Nathan is sent to him, and we pick up in chapter 12 and verses 10 and 11. Nathan tells him the story. David responds. Nathan rebukes him, and then he says, verse 10, now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house. I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor. He shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing all before all Israel, before the sun. David was completely blind to what lay ahead. In the moments of passion, he thought everything was going to be fine. I can handle this. I can take care of this. Samson was blinded to the shame and defeat that he was going to suffer because of his lack of restraint. Samson was blinded to the goodness and to the peace of walking in the Lord. Proverbs 3, verses 1 and 2. Do not forget my teaching, but keep my commands in your heart. They will prolong your life many years, bring you peace and prosperity. Verses 5 and 8, 5 through 8. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to Him and make your paths straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil. This will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones. And last, sin brings slavery. Back to the account in the book of Judges, chapter 16. And verse 21, we read a portion of it a moment ago. When the Philistines took him, put out his eyes, brought him down to Gaza, they bound him with bronze fetters. He became a grinder in the prison. This is what sin does to you. Samson, strongest man on earth, now reduced to a slave. Blind, bald, and beaten. Jesus said in John 8:34, everyone who sins is a slave of sin. Proverbs 19:13 says, keep your servant also from willful sins, that they may not rule over me. Psalm 119:133, direct my footsteps according to your word, let no sin rule over me. The Hebrew word translated rule means to have dominion over, to govern, to reign, to have power over. That's what sin does to you. That's what sin did to Samson. That's what sin did to David. Proverbs 5:22 says, the evil deeds of the wicked ensnare them. The cords of their sins hold them fast. To ensnare means to catch, to take captive. Cords are the idea of ropes here, a noose, a snare. What appropriate language. I have to wonder if the writer had Samson in mind when he wrote these words. Of course, sin is like this, regardless of whatever specifics. It ensnares you. It takes you like ropes. In fact, there's a well-known rabbinical saying, in the beginning, sin is like a thread of a spider's web, but in the end, it becomes like the cable of a ship. Psalm 9:16 says, the wicked are ensnared by the work of their hands. We talked earlier about sin bringing blindness, how the young man of Proverbs, how David couldn't see where their choices would take them, how Samson didn't see where his toying with where his strength lay was going to actually take him into slavery. In Judges chapter 16 again, verse 21, Philistines took him, put out his eyes, brought him to Gaza, bound him with fetters, bronze fetters. He became a grinder in the prison. And we recall how his hair begins to grow out in verse 22. And the Philistines had a great day of celebration and they wanted him brought out. Verses 28 through 30, when he's brought out to be made sport of, he asks a young lad to let him feel the pillars, verse 26, which support the temple, so I may lean on them. 27 says, the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. In fact, there were about 3,000 men and women on the roof who watched while Samson performed. Then Samson called to the Lord, saying, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines from my two eyes. Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple. He braced himself against them, one on his right, the other on his left. Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. He pushed with all his might. And the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it, so the dead that he killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. I'm sure that Samson never envisioned this. I'm sure he didn't envision himself blind, beaten, enslaved. I'm sure he didn't envision taking his life in this manner while he was frolicking with Delilah. Most people don't envision where sin is going to take them while they're in the midst of it. end of Samson's life could have been so different if he had made different choices, if he had refused sin. A life of sin is a wasted life. Quite contrary to the popular opinion, sin does not bring freedom. Sin brings slavery. John 8, verse 34 again, Jesus said, "Everyone who sins is a slave of sin." We see Samson going from the strongest man on earth to an impotent, beaten slave, all because of giving in to sin. And in the broader context of John 8, 34, verses 31 through 36 says, "Jesus said to the people who believed in him, 'You are truly my disciples if you remain faithful to my teachings, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' They said, 'But we are Abraham's descendants. We've never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean we will be set free?' Jesus said, 'I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave of sin. A slave is not a permanent member of the family, but a son is part of the family forever. So if the Son sets you free, you are truly free.'" Let's stand and sing the song that's been chosen.